This is One Heat Minute.
Drop of a hat, these guys will rock and roll.
What's your name?
Wayne Grove.
Look like gangbangers working the local 7-Eleven. Robbery, homicide, take me out.
Give me all you got! Give me all you got!
I do what I do best. I take scores. You do what you do best. I'm trying to stop guys like me.
A podcast dedicated to all 170 minutes of Michael Mann's LA crime opus Heat, 1 minute at a time. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to One Heat Minute. I'm your host, Blake Howard, and joining me once again, it's been pretty quick turnaround for this great friend of the show and friend of mine to come back. He is an incredible writer. He has written an incredible book, and we just talked to Kyle Turner. You guys would have heard in the Kyle Turner episode, we were talking about Public Enemies, and I mentioned this man's great book, Off the Map, Freedom Control, and the Future in Michael Mann's Public Enemies. He's the founder of the Minneapolis St. Paul Cinephile Society and also a contributor to Slant and Point magazine. Welcome back, Niall Schwartz, to One Heat Minute.
Hi.
Hello.
I love to be on One Heat Minutes. I got about 40 of them for you. So.
Excellent. We are presently rage reversing out of car spots in LA with everything that we have left in the world, which is basically a small television in our car. And we're at the 142nd minute of Michael Mann's 95 crime opus Heat. And it's 2 hours 21 minutes on the dial if you're following along on your Warner Brothers Blu-ray. Slightly seconds out for anyone with the definitive director's edition. But if you're just in the car park and Vincent has walked out of the major crimes unit and he's essentially going to shower and sleep for a month and a car, he's just reversed in the driveway, you're right there. You're right there with us. So what Niles and I are going to do is we're going to rage reverse together out of this. We're going to marvel at the incredible performances of background and supporting actors and television's being kicked out of cars. And then we're going to come back and talk to you guys about it. There it is, my friend.
Yep.
And I have a question for you. Did those people know they were in a movie, Niles? Did those people at the bus stop know they were in a movie? It's my favorite thing to wonder every time I see this scene. Oh, my goodness. I love it.
That question is very pertinent to my thesis for this whole minute, and that has to do with the tension between reality and representation. And I think, yes, they were extras. And part of Michael Mann's talent, part of a great artist's talent, is to be able to represent reality in a way that it is uncanny. And this is where the television comes in. And in Heat, television plays a major role. I mean, the first witness for the crime in Heat is the console TV man.
TV man.
He's the TV man who gets the word slick, and that is exactly what, just getting that word is what leads to Neil McCauley's downfall, really.
Yes.
So this, the movie in a way is kind of bookended by these televisions. And I think the central scene in the movie, or one of the central scenes, is where Vincent first encounters Neil, and that's through a television.
Yes.
And that in a way is interesting to me, because when Vincent goes home after that crime scene, his primary mode of intimacy is not with Justine, with his wife. It's with the TV. He wants wants to eat his chicken, his goddamn chicken with the TV.
and have a cheeky sliver of Jack Daniels to just take the edge off of the entire evening.
I feel, yeah, that's my energy sometimes too. But this is all very interesting, but going beyond Heat, and let's just go back through the corpus of Michael Mann. Let's go back to the Jericho Mile.
Yes.
And what those inmates are doing early on in the early minutes of the Jericho Mile. They're watching television, and the emphasis that Michael Mann puts on television in terms of the world, the game show world that these people are seeing, a world of fantasy being realized, you know, normal Joes and Janes getting all this money and being yes. surrounded by confetti. It's this alternate reality. And that brings me to something that Michael Mann said when he was kind of doing a penological research for Straight Time and Jericho Mile and Thief, was that there were some guys who adhere to a philosophy that you do the time, you don't let the time do you. And I think that just by subscribing to the fantasy, you know, falling into the trap of television, constant television watching is in a way having the time do you versus
absolutely.
You doing the time. Now, and let's go further. Let's go to Thief and that really perplexing shot in Thief where Frank, played by James Caan, is about to unleash hell on yes. Leo, Robert Bosky and company.
Yes.
There's a shot, a very curious shot of who a character that I assume is Leo's wife watching a television.
Yes.
And she sees Frank, or she seems to see Frank, and then almost catatonically turns away from him and back towards
it is a wonderful it's the only thing that it's comparable to in Heat is when Neil smashes Wangro's face on a cafe table and then there's a big burly what looks like truck driver with glasses, bespectacled truck driver looks up and catches Michael Cerito, Tom Sizemore's glance, and he looks at him, and in that moment he makes a decision that what he's looking at is too much trouble for him to still maintain eye contact and still think that he's going to get up and do anything, so he just puts his head down.
Understands that it's best that he even though he looks like a physically capable guy, it's not worth fucking around with these dudes.
No, it is not.
Then, of course, Manhunter's all about televisual images. The psychosis of Francis Dolarhyde is someone that relates to images. He works at a photo lab. He finds his victims through these family images of happy families, people that have accomplished a life that he can't relate to at all. And Will Graham, he's looking at a television when he's channeling, when he really gets the flavor for Francis Dolarhyde and is able to identify with him.
And also in Dolarhyde's gaze, that's the brilliant thing of Mann, is Dolarhyde's gaze in the movie is video. So it feels very televisual. And then when Will taps into that and he goes into the homes and he's ascending the stairs and there's this same video energy to the way that the shots are constructed, you're just like, ooh, that's just like a little deft formal touch. Yeah, a little bit of static, a little bit of something. There's just something so deft in that that's like, this is a great choice. This is someone who knows that you're sort of subconsciously manipulating people's perceptions here. It's great.
And even the character, the true life character, I think Dennis Wayne Wallace, the serial killer that inspired Francis Dolarhyde for Michael Mann, was someone who believed that he received messages from TV and from, power lines, that kind of thing. But,
And hilariously, Francis Dolarhyde, Tom Noonan, is in Heat, and he is literally snatching information out of the air. It's a nice little touch. Michael Mann has a sense of humor, folks. He's got a freaking great sense of humor.
In the crime story, I think the first episode, not the pilot episode, but the first episode is about a serial killer who gets messages from a TV, basically, as I recall it. And, crime story is also where we have the demo version. Dennis Farina telling his wife's lover, you can't watch my television set.
Yes.
Done not with the flourish of Al Pacino, the the Ralph scene and that classic scene. But, you know, we go on and on. Of course, the Insider and Ali are all about image, all about television and so on, and make us conscientious of how images are formed and how that they affect us psychologically and culturally. Public Enemy, same thing with John Dillinger's experience in one movie theater where everyone is sort of obeying like automatons, look to your left, look to your right, and then a subjective experience of cinema as he sees Myrna Loy on the screen. And man's genius is such that he knows through his own manipulation of those images, which is nothing like Manhattan Melodrama, the movie that we're seeing in Public Enemies, man knows that we know that John Dillinger sees Billy Frechette.
Yes.
He doesn't have to flash to an image of Marion Cotillard. He's able to transmit the information just through Myrna Loy's face. It's this beautiful sort of transmigration of the soul, I think. Which brings us back to Heat. Okay, just
Can I just say, everyone in the world who's listening to this, this is why I love Niles on this show. Like this exact conversation, I'm having a great time. I hope you are. I just want to pause and say, this is precisely why I love Niles on the show. Let's get back into it. Back to Heat.
How does Archangel Jesus de Montoya, how is he convinced by Jose Hierro that this is not casual? It's through watching a television surveillance screen image of Isabella with Sonny Crockett. So, man is conscious of how the cops and robbers movies that he's making can be very derivative. I think in interviews a lot, he uses that term derivative. And that's why even though they made great films, Jean-Pierre Merville and Jules Dassin, I don't think he likes being compared to them.
No.
And he's even been uncomplimentary towards Melville, which sounds like blasphemy, and it kind of is, I think. But, you know, he's not influenced by them. He's influenced by real life figures. And this gets to, I think, his interest in representing reality. And that could go back to how he says that his three primary influences, Stanley Kubrick, Eisenstein. But in this case, I have to emphasize, as I did in the first time we talked, Dziga Vertov.
Yes.
And the why and the struggle, the agon of the artist to represent life as it is or life unawares. And that gets back to your observation of the extras and how they don't look like actors.
Nope.
You know, but Michael Mann is a rare, great filmmaker. You know, when dealing with movie stars, whether it's Will Smith or Al Pacino or Robert De Niro or Tom Cruise, he more than any other director that I could think of, has these movie star countenances that look unconscious of themselves. In other words, more natural than other movie star performances. I watch, you know, when you watch Will Smith and Ali, it feels like you're watching Muhammad Ali in a lot of ways. It doesn't feel like this is a pretense.
I think it's like he's so aware that this larger than life, there's like a larger than life energy that is contained in this form that is Will Smith. And then he's so good at, you know, sort of enthusiastically helping them strip that away. Like, you know, it's rare that a filmmaker, you know, almost commands method, but like Will Smith's like, yeah, I want to do this role. And he was so passionate about it. He's like, I'll do 11 months of vocal coaching and fight training. You know, like that's a huge life and world commitment to do that. And similarly with Tom Cruise, like the biggest movie star in the world is breaking in wearing courier outfits and breaking into restaurants. Like he doesn't do that for the average director. there's some magical quality that he's able to convince people that if you do in these settings, you then get to, you know, you get to detach from all of the other BS that's in your life and paparazzi and nonsense. And you get to go, you know, you're just a person wearing a suit and you can travel in inconspicuously. I think that's such a thrilling thing. You know, all these guys are inconspicuously either in their characters or inconspicuously in these worlds. And, you know, what better place for Will Smith, the biggest movie star in the world, to hide than inside the biggest and most influential sports person that's ever walked the face of the earth? Like, it's just, it must be a nice holiday.
And I think another guest on your program, maybe it was you, referred to it as method directing.
Yes.
Versus method acting.
Yeah, that's I'll take credit for that one. I think that's a little phrase that I call that I coined, method directing. I find him, I find that's, and it's less about, you know, it's more about his imposition of method. You know, some people, I wouldn't say it's an imposition, but it's an inspiration. It's like it's an example of method. Like, everyone's going to be prepared. Everyone's going to have the backstory. Everyone's going to read No Beast So Fierce. Everyone's going to do gun training. Everyone's going to have interrogation training. Everyone's going to have a backstory. Everyone's going to do interviews with people who've really experienced this, because that is the paramount. I think that's what man finds as derivative. He doesn't like, and you get a sense of it in the films, he's way less interested in people whose intent is to replicate and to you know, make like this weird simulacra of something that already exists. Whereas he, as in another piece of art, you're just doing a copy, you're tracing, you know, essentially the elements together. He's way less interested in that. He's way more interested in like a tangible reflection of what an authentic experience is. So when, you know, I like to go back to his, I have this like as a permanent link that I've got, like a tab, sorry, opened in my Google Chrome, and it's like Michael Mann's top 10, actually 11 films of all time. Yeah. And they are Apocalypse Now,
yeah.
Avatar, Battleship Potemkin, so Eisenstein, Beautiful, which is Alejandro González Iñárritu, Citizen Kane, Doctor Strangelove, My Darling Clementine, Passion of Joan of Arc, Raging Bull, and The Wild Bunch. And his 11th film is Nakashima Tetsuya's 2010 movie, Confessions. And I've never seen that. I've been trying to hunt it down. But in all of these, like he talks about, you know, and one, I think that when we're talking about real life, he talks about My Darling Clementine. So he's like, it's a fine drama in the Western genre, stunningly subjective and cinematic perfection. You know, like he's talking about these things. Wild Bunch, he's like, no other picture captures the poignancy of the last of, a sense of the West, of aging, and the pathos of twilight. Like he's very, in all these movies he's talking about, and Beautiful, which is the lower depths of Barcelona, he's like, street life, the human soul, resplendent with grace, pathos, love, poetry. You know, that's, you know, he's talking about authentic portrayals, subjectivity, and pathos.
Joan of Arc, Carl Theodor Dreyer's impetus for making that movie, or one of them, was to more accurately than any other movie represent a historical event.
Yes.
And that really, part of that comes through, I think Mann might make mention in that list that you talked about, the use of close-ups.
Yes.
And the kind of the chromatic, the new film stock that Dreyer was using to get those close-ups, where you didn't need as much makeup, and Falconetti expresses so much through her face in a way that is, to this day, you know, in a league of its own.
Yes, I agree. God, that would be something good. Can we just throw that into the universe? At small art house cinemas, every now and then, just like once a year, can you play Passion of Joan of Arc? Like big, beautiful print. God damn, it's a beautiful movie.
Minneapolis here at our cathedral.
Oh, really?
With the live choir doing the Voices of Light soundtrack.
Wonderful. Absolutely wonderful. Did you get a chance to see it in that format? Yeah. Oh, my goodness.
It was the first time I went to church in quite some time.
I was just going to say. But if that's what church offered, old prints of movies with choral scores, I'd be there every Sunday. That's literally.
True religious film. But this brings us back to TV and how TV frames human beings, I think, in a, you know, a tacky way. It defines them, it frames them without dimensionalizing them. But Michael Mann wants to harmonize real life. Yes. And, you know, his movies don't have the same kind of they're a little bit more elegant than, say, Scorsese's anthropological gangster films are.
Yes.
For example, people in Michael Mann movies are kind of dressed too good. They live you've brought up many times how they live in too good residences for probably their social.
We allow the romance. That's where we get him to be his most romantic, in his property choices.
And
I'm good totally with that.
I think that here we and approaching the minute. I don't know if we've approached the minute, but we have Michael or Michael, Al Pacino, Vincent Hanna getting the front, get you know, driving away with his surrogate partner, the yes. television. Yes. And you have when it, you know, it kind of rocks in the front seat against the dash. And the music that's playing is Michael Brooks' Ultramarine.
Yes.
And we heard this music one other time in the film. And that is when Neil is having dinner with his friends who all have partners. And we get to the sense of this guy who's alone. And as this music is playing, he goes to make a phone call. And you have that deep blue behind him, that aqua blue kind of color, as he's calling Edie.
Yeah.
Cut to Edie, just as the Michael Brook guitar hits, as she's in front of her computer doing her graphic design. And it's an ushering in of Neil's longing for another person, for intimacy, for, you know, it's not just the one night, it's I want you here with me. And so what you
and the Brook score continues.
Yeah.
Until they are the subjects, and they're being observed from a perch, they're being surveilled from behind a sign. It's still lingering into that moment too.
There's the other intimate relationship in the movie between Vincent and Neil. Probably at the same time. Yeah. So it's kind
who's
of
the
a
loner blooming. Who's the loner?
Yeah, it's.
I think that can come off really creepy, Niles. But I think that, you know, if you're saying someone that you're attracted to, and you're a Heat fan, and you're among friends, and that person happens to be alone, I think it's totally fair to say, "Who's the loner?" You know, I think it's totally fair, just for anyone who's a fan of this show.
There are people who've often said that this movie is a love story between two men, and
yes.
I think the film totally offers that reading. They're the two men who are made for each other. And, you know, I think Cam Collins, for example, is one critic, K. Austin Collins, who's brought that up, at least in his tweets. I don't know if he's written anything about it. But you have the ultramarine music playing, you know, which is about the longing for a partner. And it ties in with the ocean, the water, the, you know, the aqua blue from that earlier Neil scene. And then this minute, actually, after he ditches the television, he kicks it out as yes. if Vincent is saying he's rejecting this partner, this alternative partner. He's just going to be his own person. He's just going to shower and take a nap for a month,
for a
whatever.
Month. Yep.
He's a room unto himself, a room of his own. He goes in that hotel room, and what does he step in? He steps in water. He doesn't see it. Where does he put his keys, by the way?
On top of the television. Yes.
And he goes out, looks at that window, looks at the city, which is looks like that iridescent algae, the same way that Neil and Edie, their intimacy was early on established. And at the same time, it's reflective of when Neil came home and looked out at the ocean. So you have all those ideas, you know, the city of lights, the water, ocean, intimacy, loneliness, all colliding. And I think in a way it all comes back to that song. And yeah, it's funny when it's hilarious. I think when Vincent kicks out that television, it's sort of cathartic. It's in a way, it's just the ultimate fuck it, whatever. It's sort of,
yeah,
everything
sort of
that.
I think it's so, you know, there's such, as you just sort of articulated, there's so many elements, and in this movie, it's like especially as we're heading into this sequence, you know, it's the 142nd minute of a movie that has 166 minutes of screen time, and this final act that is just a whole, it's a rich tapestry of all of these echoes, of match cuts, of match themes, of match music, of match philosophy, of you know, inverted shots that were seen so many times throughout the film. And I think what's so funny about this moment is that before we have all of this great, you know, when he's in the car and the music happens, to get Vincent to this point where he's in this inverse moment, he's exhausted every trick he has in the book. He's exhausted all of his mental capacity, all of his being able to read and preempt Neil's behavior from that, you know, this really brazen thing of sitting in front of a coffee shop and in front of him. He's exhausted all of his leads, his traps. And in this moment, when he feels like Neil's escaped the noose, this last thing, this defiant totem of like, I'm taking some charge of my life as I'm leaving this postmodern dead tech shithole house. He's like, it means nothing. I think in that weird way, it's like that TV means a lot to him in his little private quiet moments where he can just have a moment to himself and he can be quietly distracted. He can just let time do him in the evenings and nothing is, you know, the white noise of television just helps quiet his mind that is racing a mile a minute. But I think the defeatist kick of that television out the car, which is brilliant and has these incredible, uncannily real and authentic performances of people perplexed that Al Pacino just kicked the television out of the car, which is my favorite thing to think. It's maybe the best extra performance ever, because it's literally, I feel like if this was these days, it would be like a person going on their phone, like going, Al Pacino just kicked the TV out of the car. Like it's this great moment, but he kicks it out. And to your point, Niles, it's like, yes, it's catharsis. Yes, it is. But it's like, it's a devastating catharsis, because it's like this last totem of what is real life. I've sacrificed everything to try and catch this guy, and I've ended my third marriage, and this is where I am. And yet I stand empty-handed here. Like I'm empty-handed and I'm empty. And there's no satisfying where I'm at this moment. It's like the peak deflation. That kick is where he kicks away. It's just nothing left.
It's a variation of what Frank does at the end of Thief in a lot of ways.
Big time.
You know, not just where, you know, he doesn't kick the television, but he blows up goddamn house and he blows up the goddamn Green Mill in Chicago. Our lot, you know, but there's something as absurd and ridiculous about that gesture that, you know, goes to a private subjective thing that only Frank understands in that instance, and just as the television, only Vincent really understands that in that instance. And that's why it's a great moment, because that's something that only one person understands. It you see the cutback to the extras watching it, what the hell does that mean? The audience feels the same. You know, I think we understand what it means on a very subconscious level perfectly. That's why it works.
Yes,
but at the same time, it's something
he doesn't have to say a word. That's what's beautiful.
For this careless individual, Vincent Hanna, he doesn't. That says as much as any other thing that Pacino has said throughout the whole 3-hour film. With, you know, and that's a beautiful thing, I think. But yeah,
it's
awesome stuff.
It's so good. It's so good. All started from the console TV man, from Bosco's console TV man, and this TV that's been so important. And what's even funnier is that this is just a small touch, but he has a remote and he's holding the remote to that television, and the television is so close that he could touch the television. This is what I've always been perplexed by. It's so close. He can touch it, but he just won't change the channel with his hand. Another interesting choice. More for us to ponder. But yeah, look, and we encroach on what is like a devastating moment of the film. And again, this is where the music flips from Ultramarine and takes a very somber tone, and Vincent's sort of melancholic observations, which sort of encroach into the next minute, so we won't go into too much detail, but I just love that there's a foreshadowing, and this is the distraction that goes to Vincent's mindset, which is, you know, again, to really, you know, at the same time as not bearing the lead with what we're about to see, we sort of get a bit of foreshadowing that something is not right. But it's so anti-Vincent to not notice that. You know, to walk into a room and not pick up those details. Like, this is the guy who's, like, pointing at things on a crime scene late at night. And he's like, I can see all the things that I want an answer to, and you better have an answer for me. And in this moment, he's like, well, I don't know.
Well, he's expired. He's done. I mean, at the beginning of the movie, we see him have sex with Justine, and what cuts to him taking the shower. And here he's, as he leaves the police station, says, so long, motherfucker, you were good, which is something, again, bringing up this sort of homoerotic undercurrent. But I think there's something to it that he says, so long, motherfucker, you were good, I'm going to take a shower. That's it. He's gone, you know. That's fucking power of speech. That applies to his professional life. He's just like, I'm done for the month. I'm just turning off. I'm going to a hyper-real environment, a hotel room, which is not a real, quote-unquote, real place. It's, you know, a duplicate one of many other rooms and one big house, basically. And, yeah, meanwhile, Neil is in the midst of living his own fantasy. He's with Edie, and he's going to go kill Wayne Grove eventually. And, you know, that's where your guests in the future will deal with. But something I want to bring up here, and it has to do with even though I've talked about the music, but the music for Heat, I don't know how many times you guys have talked about the source music for Heat, because the soundtrack for Heat changed my life. And I loved hearing Ultramarine the first time when I saw Heat in the theaters, and you know, I got the soundtrack, and you know, on that soundtrack, it sort of, as a teenager, that was sort of a gateway to so many artists. And that was in the 90s, in the maybe the early 2000s, movie soundtracks were kind of a gateway. And here you had not only the Golden, but you had the Kronos Quartet playing Golden
Kronos
Call.
You've got Brian Eno,
Michael Brook. I can never say it without spelling it Einstur, or without, you know, sounding Einstürzende Neubauten.
Yes.
You know, this industrial band, you know, a lot of goth industrial people, and they love them. And of course, this Lisa Gerrard, you know, and this led me to Dead Can Dance, then William Orbit, James, Daniel Lanois. But most significantly, you know, there was Moby, but through Moby, Joy Division. And
yes.
Your theme song, The New Dawn Fades, you know, I'd never heard of Joy Division or New Order yet. And then I was like, what is this? And then I think Trainspotting came out the next year, and I got that soundtrack, and that had what's my favorite all-time pop song, Temptation by New Order. I'm like, oh, and it's written by the same people. But all this music just sort of crashed in on me, and it was such a, you know, this avant-pop, you know, art rock kind of stuff. It was different from other, you know, like Casino came out around in this, you know, within a month, and you know, it's another great soundtrack, but it's pop standards and
lots of classic. There's no one better than a needle drop. I would argue there's no one better at a needle drop than Scorsese. Like, there's literally no one that's better. And so it's a total contrast to this album. Like, you've got, you know, we talked about the Giorgio Ligeti, the concerto for violoncello and orchestra, which is a Kubrick, you know, a Kubrick grab from another Kubrick film. There's, you know, B.B. King, Thrill Is Gone. You know, there's so much here. Steve Roach, you know, Solitaire, the Black Cloud music. And Lisa Gerrard goes on to do a bunch of stuff for the Insider soundtrack, which comes out later. So you've kind of got this great, the Michael Mann needle drop is like, it feels like it's all about organic incidental music. It almost feels like incidental music. If you go into a club, that's where you hear the needle drop.
Yeah.
And the other selections are so bespoke. You know, they're theme tunes for characters without being theme tunes for characters. They're theme tunes for emotional themes of whatever arc we're working on in that story at the time.
That's the thing, is that when I saw Heat, it was I didn't know that it was a bunch of source music. I thought, a lot of this is Golden Tall and the Kronos Quartet, and you know, for all I knew, New Dawn Fades, you know, there's so much guitar in this texture in the soundtrack, it could have been Golden Tall. Young, you know, virgin ears at that time, but but you know, as time went on, you know, Michael Mann soundtracks. I felt wonderful when Miami Vice came out, because a couple years before that, it was the same weekend that Collateral came out. Actually, I was on my way to a rock concert headlined by The Cure and Interpol and The Rapture, and this band called Mogwai was playing, and I was just becoming familiar with Mogwai, and I had bought Happy Songs for Happy People. And as I was listening to this, as driving to Chicago from Minneapolis, like, this stuff would be great for a Michael Mann movie.
Yes.
God, this is wonderful for Michael Mann. And then when Miami Vice came out, it was like, oh my God, two Mogwai tracks.
And talk about, you know, when you talk about, like, I was talking about, it's so funny in the previous episode, I was talking about Audioslave. I'm like, Audioslave is the perfect, like, at the time of, you know, Collateral, Miami Vice is like the perfect band to be in a Michael Mann movie. It's just got that, you know, there's something, you know, may you rest in peace. Chris Cornell's voice has just got this melancholy and this steel and this grit that is just so, it's like all the things that a really uber cool Michael Mann character wants to be, Chris Cornell's voice can convey in a track, you know, just like, and you know, Morello's sort of obsessively percussive guitar licks that underscore that. It's just like, oh, this is great. It's great.
Mm-hmm. I mean, a lot of people shit on the Audioslave. I frankly find it fine. You know, I understand why Michael Mann really likes Chris Cornell, and it reflect, you know, as he says, you know, the vocal reflects the inner lives of his characters, I think. So, I mean, that's something I think it's more difficult these days compared to the 90s, even just to license music. It's like impossible. You know, when you think about all the music that Scorsese got into Mean Streets for as little money as he had, or even Who's That Knocking at My Door, a student film in 68, you know, Black Hat has very little, it has apparently a lot of source music is in it, but it's nothing as I think familiar as what you had in Vice or Collateral or Insider.
No, the most recent thing that sort of flummoxed me when I watched it, and nothing to do with content, but just the needle drops. I was watching Ricky Gervais's new show on Netflix, Afterlife, and it's like, it has Robert Zemeckis level needle drops. Like, it is unbelievable the tracks that has, and I know that he's quite a purveyor of pop music through the ages. So they're very sort of, you know, that's why I call it Zemeckis. They're very sort of pop relevant. You know, sometimes you'd say bordering on gratingly obvious music choices, but they're huge. They're like Fleetwood Mac and, you know, just massive songs that are happening all through this show. And I'm like, God, Netflix must have paid through the teeth for these needle drops. Like, unbelievable. You couldn't do that in cinema if you didn't have Netflix money to go, yeah, I want to add this song. I want to do this. You know, maybe they got a discount. I'm not sure.
I'm sure that The Irishman will, you know, I know that Robbie Robertson is working on The Irishman. He tweeted about it.
Yes.
So I'm sure that'll have tons of interesting news. So I'm looking forward to it. But anyway, the thing when I talk about the Ultramarine and Heat, though, and we talk about how fast, I mean, Heat was made very quickly, at least post-production, I think, was very quick for a movie of that scale, and
two 24-hour editing teams working on different times. Sorry, a 24-hour editing team working in two multiple suites.
To give you an idea of how fast that was, I told you last time that I saw Heat 4 times theatrically.
Yes.
The second time I saw it, you know how the film ends with a Michael Mann film.
Yes.
Second time I saw it, a Michael Mann film was at the beginning of the movie. So it's like at the last minute, he was still juggling whether or not to have it at the end or at the beginning, I think. And some prints were made with it.
At the beginning. That's amazing. So
but when it first came out on VHS videotape, during this minute that we're talking about, there was no Ultramarine music. He had taken it out, or they just forgot to put it in or something. Thankfully for the letterbox VHS version of Heat, it was back in.
Oh my God.
It gives you an idea how many times I bought Heat over the years. But
I was just going to say, I've got it. I definitely had a copy of it on VHS, but in Australia, that like widescreen VHSs in Australia were like, they didn't exist. The first one that I can remember that had a wide release for widescreen was, and maybe this was in more, you know, cult video stores and things like that, but certainly in the suburbs where I was, like not an hour north of Sydney when I was growing up, the only widescreen movie I ever saw on a VHS was Star Wars. Like when they did reissues of Star Wars movies, like they were like the first ones that became sort of, you know, popular locally. But, you know, at the time, definitely had Heat on VHS, had it on DVD, then had it on DVD again for special editions, then had it on, you know, Blu-rays and multiple Blu-rays and DVDs all since then. But it's so like, it's so unconscionable now that people are like, oh yeah, like you can't get a widescreen version. Like, how strange is that?
On our old console TVs.
Yeah. You've got
on
the
console. Our old console TVs, that widescreen look, that letterbox looked, upset a lot of people. And the first time I saw it, interestingly enough, was Last of the Mohicans, which went straight to rental in widescreen, not in the proper 235:1, but in a kind of a compromised 185:1.
Yes.
Version. And I know a lot of people that watched it and were just really pissed off because they said, oh, the scene is cut out. And I was trying to explain, no, you have more scenery, but you're watching it on a television that's, you know,
tiny, even excruciatingly if it's, even tiny.
If it's tiny, you know, because this is pre-widescreen television.
But even like, you know, I grew up with many TVs that are smaller than my 13-inch laptop, you know, and way less clear. Yeah, it's so funny. But no, you know, that's part of his artistry, right? What he's driving with here is a very, it's much in the same command that he has the emotional trajectory of the movie alongside, you know, what people should be feeling emotionally alongside the characters and the performance. I think a needle drop in a Michael Mann movie is often disruptive. Like he's having to be. It's when he decides to be, you know, both metaphorical and literal at the same time that I feel like there's a needle drop. Like he can just go bang and throw like a big message and try and echo characters' inner workings. But Heat is such a work of subtle brilliance, and these complementary factors that are happening over the whole spectrum of this big epic, that I think any of those needle drops feel too disruptive at this point in the movie. This movie is like right now, especially where we're ratcheted up the tension, the final act of the film. You know, there's no lack of complete control that's happening in this final run to the finish line. Mm-hmm. Oh my goodness. Well, look, ladies and gentlemen, I think that's the perfect way to exit. This has been an absolute thrill to talk to Niles again. And I took the time to say it in the middle of the episode, but that sort of intertextual understanding of Michael Mann's sort of thematic journey is exactly why I love talking to Niles, particularly whether it's like formal or character or influence, and you know, a guy who doesn't need to maybe keep a tab on permanently on his Google Chrome of Michael Mann's top 10 movies to know what each of these little comments and blurbs say about them, but I love him to death for it. So Niles, thank you so much for being a part of the show. You've been a huge part. Your three episodes have been amazing, and I just wanted to say thank you for being a part of the show. If we don't get to speak before the infamous end credits, thank you so much for being a part of the show.
I wanted to thank you for having me on the show three times. I'm so honored, and I love listening to the show, and I admire so many other of the other guests, and it's wonderful to be in such good company.
Oh, well, you're welcome. You belong here, sir. You're right here with all of us other crazy people that are obsessed with this film and not. Look, ladies and gentlemen, if you're going to do two things at the end of this show. You're going to go and follow Niles at Niles Files on Twitter. And then the other best place that you can find him is you can click on the link that's in the description to go and buy Niles' book. And if you can't get a physical copy, or you don't, you know, you prefer a Kindle, that's how you can get it. That's how I got it, which is on Amazon.com. You can check it out, Off the Map, and Freedom, Control, and the Future in Michael Mann's Public Enemies. And it is an absolutely phenomenal read, and you would have got a sense of Niles's writing style in the way that he kind of traverses time and influence and theme, and sort of how he then is able to bring it back to what he's trying to say in this very episode. So it's been an absolute thrill talking to him about it. So thank you guys for listening. Thank you, Niles, once again for being a part of the show and all your support and generosity of time and spirit. So thank you, sir. Thank you guys for listening again. OneHeatMinute.com is where you can find us and all good podcasting subscribers. Thank you to Mr. Garth Franklin for our website design, Mr. Paul Davies for our theme, And we'll catch you in another episode of One Heat Minute just around the corner. Just have a listen to some Ultramarine and kick the living daylights out of that TV as you're getting out of the car.